afternoon. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Joseph Schroeder of neuroscience. Professor Schroeder joined Dengue College in 2004, and in 2011 he received the John S. King Faculty Award for Excellence in Teaching. His courses include the neurobiology of disease, cognitive brain imaging, psychology of sleep, and a first year seminar titled Genius, Creativity, and Brain. Professor Schroeder holds a BA from Franklin Marshall and a PhD from Thomas Jefferson University.
Thank you, Nathan.
So thanks for coming out. I'm sorry about the weather on the union weekend. That certainly puts a little bit of a damper on things. What I'd like to talk to you about today is the outcome of a course that was offered for the first time this past semester, the spring semester. It's called Psychology of Sleep. And we took a sort of a different approach than some of the other courses that I teach, in that the students were able to monitor their own sleep state, the sleep patterns, and then reflect upon them in a way that hopefully by the end of the semester they were able to improve their sleep and then thus improve the quality of their lives. So, and we use a unique way of doing that, which I'll explain to you as we go along. Okay, so let's start off with a sort of a background overview of sleep and the stages of sleep. This is a typical depiction of a normal night of sleep. So it's number of hours from when you go to bed and when you wake up. And so what it illustrates is the stages of sleep that are characterized as stage 1, stage 2, stage 3 and 4, and then also REM sleep, which is here in red. And in a typical night of sleep, a person will take generally 15, 20 minutes to fall asleep. So we're starting here, and then we progress into stage 1 sleep, to stage 2 sleep, to stage 3 and 4 sleep. And as you progress through these, stage 4 is the deepest part of sleep. Okay? Stage 1 sleep is oftentimes, you don't even know that you're in stage 1 sleep. Sometimes it happens for students sitting in these seats. You know, students are like this. That's actually stage 1 sleep. So you may say, no, I'm not sleeping. But you know you're sort of drifting off. Okay. So we'll progress through stage 1, light sleep, to stage 2, 3, 4, which is the deepest part of sleep. And within the first hour of sleep, that's the first sort of cycle into the deepest stage. We'll stay in stage 4 for about 30 minutes or so, and then cycle back up through 3, 2, 1, and then enter the first period of REM sleep. And
what does REM mean?
I was just going to say that. In fact, please interrupt me as we go along. I'd be happy to entertain questions as you get them instead of waiting until the end, because I think it sort of adds to the quality of the discussion. REM sleep stands for rapid eye movement. And it's also called paradoxical sleep, which I'll explain in a second. But it gets its name rapid eye movement sleep because of a discovery back in the 1950s that when a person is in this stage of sleep, there's a movement of the eyes when the eyes are closed, right? But the eyeball is moving rapidly side to side. And if you wake someone up out of REM sleep, that's when most people will report having a dream. So dreaming occurs during REM sleep. It doesn't say that dreaming only occurs during REM sleep. We do dream in other stages, but the typical type of dream, the ones that are the sort of bizarre stories that happen, the ones that are sort of memorable and sort of weird, that is a typical REM dream. So we enter the first stage of REM sleep about an hour and a half to 2 hours into sleep, and then we'll cycle back through after about 20 minutes or so of REM sleep through stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and then back up, 4, 3, 2, 1, and so forth, throughout the course of the night. And notice also that in the latter stages of the night, we'll skip over 3 and 4. And we'll just cycle from stage 1 to 2 back up to REM, 1 to 2 back up to REM. And in the latter stages of the what's called the nycthermion, the period of sleep, the REM periods are longer. And as I said before, we don't have as much stage 3 and stage 4 sleep. Stage 3 and stage 4 sleep is what is typically thought of as the refreshing sleep. The more stage 3 and 4 sleep, the better you feel when you wake up. Typically, the REM periods are, the period in between REM periods are quicker in the, or shorter in the latter stages of the sleep, and oftentimes we'll wake up after our last dream. And those are the dreams that we most typically will remember. If you have a dream in the middle of the night and don't awaken from it, chances are that you will not remember it the next day. So that's oftentimes why nightmares, for example, are memorable, because they oftentimes wake us up. And waking us up right as from a dream, from a REM dream or a nightmare, will allow us to reflect upon it and then sort of ingrain it into memory better, right? But if we end the dream and then go back into the stage 2, 3, 4, we're not able to reflect upon it and we're not able to remember it. So the way sleep is typically measured is with a recording called an EEG. It stands for electroencephalography. And these squiggly red lines represent the pattern of the EEG, of electrical activity recorded from the scalp, right? So it's basically the collective activity of the cortex underneath an electrode that's just pasted to the scalp. And you have typically, if you go to a sleep lab, they'll have, say, 20 of these electrodes placed all over the scalp. And this is a typical recording of somebody who's awake, somebody who's in stage 1 sleep, which is characterized by what are called alpha rhythms. Stage 2 sleep is characterized by sleep spindle, stage 3 by delta waves. Here's stage 4, larger, more well-defined delta waves. So you notice the pattern or the difference between waking in stage 1 versus stage 4. And also, down here at the bottom is REM sleep. And notice how REM sleep is very similar to stage 1 or to waking. That's why REM sleep is called paradoxical sleep. Paradox, of course, is a mystery, right? And it's thought that during REM sleep, the brain is actually in a wakeful state. At least according to the electrical activity, it is very similar to when you are in a waking state compared to, say, stage 3 or stage 4. So that's why it's called paradoxical sleep. It's when dreaming occurs, and one of the hypotheses about what dreams actually are is that they are sort of random memories that are, the brain is sort of grabbing a memory from here and grabbing a memory from here and grabbing a memory from here, and they could be just memories of the past day or the past week or significant events in your life, but they're unrelated. And because the brain is in kind of this wakeful state, it wants to make sense of all these inputs that's happening to it. They're not normal sensory inputs, but they're memories of things that have happened to you. So, and if they're unrelated, the brain is trying to put them together into a story, and then that's why oftentimes dreams are bizarre. It's because these memories are unrelated. The brain is trying to make sense of them, but really can't do it from a sort of realistic or logical state. Okay, so these are EEG patterns. And has anyone ever been to a sleep lab? Yes? Does this look familiar to you? So in a sleep lab, if you are, say, an insomniac, or if you have sleep apnea, a physician will refer you to a sleep lab, and you'll have to spend the night in, it's usually a hotel room. There's actually one right across the river here in Groton in the hotel that's up there by Walmart. It's run by L&M Hospital. You go to this hotel room, and in an adjacent hotel room, they have all the equipment that is monitoring the information coming from these electrodes. So this, you can't see it, but this woman has electrodes positioned all over her scalp, right? And these three electrodes right here, here, and here are recording the eye movement, the muscles controlling the eye. And these electrodes are recording the level of activity of the muscles in the jaw. There may also be an EKG monitor, a monitor that's measuring respiratory rate, oftentimes galvanic skin response. So you're hooked up to all these wires, right? And you're sleeping in a foreign environment. So it's not really the best way to get an idea of what your real sleep patterns are, what's happening to you at home. So clearly, they try to make you as comfortable as possible, but with all these wires hanging off of you, who could get a normal night of sleep? So polysomnography, poly means, of course, multiple. Som means sleep, and graphy means, of course, recording. And it means, the poly part means that you're recording muscle activity from the eye, electrical activity from the scalp, and all the other parameters that I mentioned to you. What has happened in the last, say, 4 or 5 years is that the technology and our ability to record deep sleep patterns has changed, and it's now shifted from a sleep lab to data collection in your own bedroom. And when I heard about this, my interest in neuroscience and electrical activity of the brain, recording electrical activity of the brain, when I saw these new devices, I thought this would be great to try and use it as an application in my own research or in a course. The system that I'm talking about is called the Zio system. You can get more information about it here at myzio.com, but basically it works, this is it right here. It's a headband that has 3 soft electrodes, and you wear it like this, and it records electrical activity from the frontal cortex. This is all you have to do to get ready for this. Just put this thing on, and it records, it communicates wirelessly with a little dock, or actually this dock is just for charging it. But if you have a smartphone, you can download a free app on your smartphone that this will communicate with through the Bluetooth of your phone and record your EEG patterns from your frontal cortex. If you don't have a smartphone, you can buy this version. This is actually the old version, and it's being phased out in favor of the smartphone application. But it's a little bedside unit that looks like an alarm clock. And this headband will sit in the dock on top here when you're not using it to recharge. And the display here is just like an alarm clock display that'll show you what time it is, but it'll also tell you what stage of sleep you're in. And you can buy one of these. This one is $99, and the smartphone version is $79. So for my course in the psychology of sleep, instead of asking the students to buy a textbook for the course, I said, buy one of these, and we're going to record everybody's sleep throughout the semester to make this big data set of 40-plus students in the course, and collectively be able to answer some questions about this, about college student sleep and the quality of college student sleep. And at the end of the course, hopefully you'll be able to learn something about your own sleep patterns and how to improve them, and maybe actually implement some of the ideas that we learned in the class to improve your sleep quality and improve your academic experience and your overall personal life. So, this is the website. When you buy one of these, you can create your own account that all of your information is uploaded to the website, and it's, let's see here, it's recorded. This is actually my data from January 26th when I was getting ready to teach this course. And what it shows you is that when I went to bed here at about, I guess, 10:30 or so on January 26th, it shows that in the first, each one of these little bars is a time increment of, I think it's 5 minutes. So I fell asleep within about 5 minutes and then entered light sleep, and then had a period of deep sleep about an hour into the nycthermion, and then had my first REM period about an hour and a half later. Very typical of that first slide that I showed you. And then this regular cycle through light sleep, deep sleep, back up to REM, light sleep to REM, light sleep, and so forth. It also shows you how many times you woke up during the night. So for example here, this is probably when my cat jumped on the bed and woke both of us up, and I couldn't get back to sleep. And overall, it'll tell you, it'll give you a breakdown of how much time you spent in, like, how much you spend in light sleep, in REM sleep, in deep sleep. And it calculates what's called a ZQ score. That's over here. The 77 is a ZQ score, which is similar to an IQ score. The higher the score, the better. And it's basically an indicator of the quality of your sleep. It also, this data collection is coordinated with a sleep journal that most people opt to do, which you can choose what kind of questions you want to keep track of. And so when all the students bought these Zio systems, I said, what parameters of sleep do you want to keep track of? And so we decided from a list of about 40 different questions that the system will keep track of as the factors that we wanted to keep track of in our class. So for example, students wanted to know about stress. So when you wake up in the morning, you put your headband back into the dock and you can use your phone or your computer to log on to your account and answer these questions. So for example, the anticipation, anxiety, and stress question was, you gave yourself a score. If you didn't have anything stressful going on that day that worried me last night, you give yourself a 0 versus a 3 if you were up late because of anticipation or stress. Other questions that the students were interested in were caloric intake, for example. That's what bedtime hunger refers to. Caffeine intake, alcohol intake. So, for example, alcohol, you give yourself a 0 if you have 0 drinks, or 1 if you had 1 to 2 drinks, or a 3 if you had 5+ drinks within 3 hours of bedtime. And then there was also, they were interested in questions about exercise, about level activity. So there's a growing body of evidence that suggests that screen activity, just exposure to a television screen or a phone screen or a computer screen, robs you of a good quality sleep. That's what level of activity was. Late work just refers to how intensive they were studying, for example. So they answered all these questions as they recorded data. And then, so I collected all of this data and put it together in a big spreadsheet. And I want to show you some of the findings that we came up with. First of all, I had them collect, we did a pilot study last spring with my behavioral neuroscience class, and I had a grant from the college to buy 10 of these units and gave them out to the students in the class and collected data to see if it was going to work so that I could create the psychology of sleep class. And this is a paper that we published last year in the Journal of Undergraduate Neuroscience Education. Jillian Marshall is a master's student, just graduated here at the college, that we published on our pilot data. And based on that data, we thought that the system would be a good application for a course. That's what made me propose psychology of sleep as a new course to offer. So the first thing I asked them to do was to collect 10 nights of sleep in the first, say, 3 weeks of the semester. So when they got here in January, I said, by February 21st, I want you to get used to wearing this headband and record your sleep data, just to make sure that you're getting a good recording every night, and upload 10 nights of sleep to your website, and then give me all those numbers. And of course, we made sure that it was all anonymous. I didn't know whose data was whose. And this is some of the initial baseline data that we collected. The mean ZQ score for the students in the class was 81. That is a little bit above average for the ZEO system.
What's the range, by the way? Is it through 100 or?
So some people can get a ZQ score that's up in the, say, 120s. But if you are, say, only getting 2 hours a night of sleep and you're up worrying and regularly awakening throughout the night, you might get a ZQ score that's in the 20s. So there's a pretty wide range. So remember, it's an overall just sort of indicator of general quality of sleep. So the mean ZQ score was 81 with a standard deviation of 18. Students spent about 400 or so minutes altogether of sleep, so that's almost 7 hours. What is recommended for a good night of sleep is 8 hours. But very few of us actually get 8 hours, and that's reflected in the college student sleep. 407 minutes of actual sleep took them about 18 minutes to fall asleep. 7 wakings throughout the night, about almost 2 hours in REM sleep. That's actually pretty good. 2 hours out of 7 spent in REM sleep is pretty good. Light sleep, deep sleep, and number of awakenings. Or this is actually number of minutes spent in wakefulness, and this is number of awakenings. This is just some of the general baseline data that we collected. So they, of course, wanted to know, well, how does it differ in men versus women? In general, none of these were statistically significant, but in general, women had a lower ZQ score than men. They spent less time in sleep. They spent less time in REM sleep. As I said, none of these are statistically significant. Perhaps with a larger N number of students in the course, it might have reached significance. But just in general, 86 ZQ score for men versus 80 for women. Men spent about a half an hour more in sleep than women did. About 20 minutes more in REM time than women. They were interested in how do seniors, juniors differ from sophomores and first years. In general, there was not a huge difference here. Keep in mind that this is only a difference of 2 or 3 in the ZQ score, but in general, seniors and juniors had a lower quality of sleep than sophomores and first years. Again, not a big difference. They were interested in how does it vary by day? And we had some hypotheses about what we would find there. What day do students get their best sleep? And we found that was actually on Wednesday. Of course, on the weekends, they're up later and probably sleeping in later also. And in general, that is a poor indicator of sleep quality. If you go to bed late and wake up late on the weekends and then adopt a regular sleep cycle during the weekdays, that is pretty bad for your overall quality of sleep. It's better if you go to sleep at the same time and wake up at the same time every day. Of course, students don't do that. They got poor ZQ scores on Friday and Saturday. This is Friday night, this is Saturday night. We thought, given the current history at the college, that Thursday would also be a low ZQ score, but it actually wasn't. They got some pretty good sleep on Thursday nights. But again, there wasn't a large difference between ZQ scores for across the days of the week. So we had all of these different parameters. Remember, hunger, caffeine intake, alcohol intake, exercise, and so forth. So we did correlations between the parameters that the ZO system was giving us and all of those sleep journal questions. So this is the ZQ score, which is, remember, a general indicator of sleep quality, versus all those sleep journal questions. And what you see here are correlation coefficients on the first line, here and here. And whether they were, this is the significance level, and yes and no means was the correlation significant. So in general, the way correlations work, it goes from +1 to -1. And if you get a correlation that's +1, that's a perfect correlation. That means as one variable increases, another variable, the pairing variable will increase. Or if both of them are going down, if one's going down, the other one will go down with it. That'll give you a positive correlation. A negative correlation happens when the two variables go in opposite directions. So as one decreases, the other one increases. So just for example here, let's see, caffeine intake has a negative correlation, and that was significant. That means as the more caffeine they drank, the lower their ZQ score was. Okay. Same for alcohol. The more alcohol they drank, the lower their ZQ score was. The correlation for exercise was, for example, was not significant. Screen time was significant. That is, the more time they spent on a screen, looking at a screen, the lower their ZQ score was. Some of the positive correlations were, of course, this day one field, day two field, day three field is just a three general questions about how well do you think you slept, how well do you feel today. Are you energetic and focused and ready to go, or are you sort of tired and lackluster? So this is just a snapshot of the 100 or so of correlations that we ran between, not only, this is only ZQ versus everything, but we also ran correlations between, for example, REM time and alcohol consumption, and say deep sleep and anxiety. So we could go back and look at all these different correlations. Here's another couple more. The course students were interested in alcohol. And remember, it's an alcohol score of 0 means they didn't drink anything. This is is, pointers die on me. This is 1 to 2 drinks, this is, I think, 3 to 4 drinks, and this is 5 or more drinks within 3 hours of bedtime, correlated with how much time they spend in REM time, which is, remember, the dream state. So what you see here is this correlation is significant. It's a negative correlation, meaning the more alcohol you drink, the less time you spend in REM. I was pleased to see this N refers to the number of students who reported a 0 versus the number of students who reported a 7. So what we did, we had 40 or so students in the course, and each of them had to record 10 nights of data. So we treated each night of data as its own N. So we had about 400 nights of sleep that we could analyze. So out of those 400 nights of sleep, only 7 students reported drinking 5 or more drinks within 3 hours of going to bed. 256 reported 0, which I was pleased with. Maybe it's not exactly altogether true. I don't think they were all convinced that it was truly anonymous, so maybe they were sort of maybe afraid of reporting and having that as part of a record. But I didn't know whose data was whose. REM time versus stimulating activity, that's screen time. In general, and again, this is a negative correlation that was significant at 0.0002. The more screen time you have, the less time you're spending in REM. Really, one of the main findings that we had from the course in general was that the main thing that affects college student sleep is anxiety and stress, which of course is understandable, and that's reflected here in this graph. An anxiety score of 3 means that you are really stressed out about something, and that was a very significant at 0.22 correlation coefficient. Anxiety score of 3. And this is time to Z. How long does it take you to fall asleep? So if you reported an anxiety score of 3, that generally took you about almost an hour to fall asleep, versus an anxiety score of 0 is about 15 or so minutes to fall asleep. Alcohol intake and time to fall asleep, sort of common sense, right? The more alcohol you drink, the faster you fall asleep, and that's what we found. 5 or more drinks took them about 5 minutes to fall asleep versus 0 drinks, the typical 15 or 20 minutes to fall asleep. Okay, so the second thing that we did in the course was to, I awarded them points for how much they contributed to this data set. So they got 10 points towards their one aspect of their course grade. For giving me that 10 nights of data at the beginning of the semester. And then I said, okay, well, the first test is coming up. It was on February 21st. I said, if you record your sleep data on February 20th, you get 5 points for recording one night. So it was an incentive to make sure that they cooperated with the data set. We were interested in how do these sleep variables change when they are stressed about an upcoming exam the next day. Right? So we were comparing their baseline data on the first 3 weeks of the semester to that one night of data right before the first exam. And their ZQ score, in general, during the first 3 weeks of the semester was an 80, versus on the night before the exam, it dropped to 73. And that, believe it or not, that is a significant, we did a t-test on this, and that's a significant difference because we had such a large number of nights of sleep. How much sleep did they get? They got about 400 minutes of sleep before the test on the baseline data versus, so that's a 362 right on the night before the test. So they're getting about 40 minutes less sleep a night the night before. We calculated what the actual bedtime was from the data. They go to bed in general at 1 o'clock in the morning on a typical night. On the night before the test, it's not much difference, so 1:11 in the morning. And the standard deviation here is from 11:33 to 2:30 in the morning. That's when the majority of students are going to sleep. This is one of those sort of general how do you feel questions. How well you feel you slept last night, ranging from 1 to 5. During the first 3 weeks of the semester, they rated themselves as 3.3 versus the night before the test, they said 2.79, probably because of the anxiety associated with the upcoming exam. How do you feel today? Again, a drop from the beginning of the semester to the night before the exam. This is the main big factor that we found. Anxiety and stress. Here are the questions that they had to respond to or rate themselves about their level of stress. Before the 3 weeks before the exam, 0.79, so we're right in between these two. The night before the exam, that anxiety score shot up to 2.05. Caffeine intake. They drank 1 serving the night before of caffeine before the exam versus less than a serving of caffeine during the regular 3 weeks. I thought that was surprising that they would actually have more caffeine when they knew that they had to get better sleep than the night before the exam. Question? Level of activity. This is how stimulating their activity was right before they went to bed. It was more stimulating the night before the exam compared to the 3 weeks before the test. Not surprising if they're studying. How late were you up working last night? So despite the fact that there was only a 5 minute or so difference in their reported bedtime, their rating of when they went to sleep, what they thought of was their typical bedtime was later during the pretest than the night before the test versus the 3 weeks before the semester started, 3 weeks at the beginning of the semester. And of course, we were interested in exam scores. How well does the score on your first exam correlate with your quality of sleep the night before? Okay? So this is actually the exam score versus the number of hours of sleep that you got. So the students that got less than 4 hours of sleep had an average of 69 on the first exam. Okay? Versus the students who got 8+ hours of sleep had a score of 84. So when you show them this data, you give them their exam back. And they think, what, how many hours did I sleep? And so they can go back and check it. And they say, well, where did I fall? And most of them, you know, this is actually a good sort of lesson for them, real-world application of what they were learning in class. I kept telling them over and over again, you want to do well on the exam? Make sure you get enough sleep. And so this was sort of driven home, this message of the importance of sleep. Yes?
What do you think about the fact that people who were better prepared already or just knew the information better might have been less stressed today?
Yeah, of course that was part of it. So we could tease this data apart maybe even a little better and look at anxiety, right? And of course, low anxiety leads to better quality of sleep, so you get more sleep. So it would be difficult to tease that apart, but yeah, of course. If they space their studying out over the course of the exam, the period before the exam, then they're probably going to be less stressed, they'll get better quality of sleep, and their exam scores will. So we wanted to see how our students compared to other studies that have examined sleep in college students. And remember, this is a brand new system. So the studies that looked at college student sleep in their own environments are non-existent. Right? If there were sleep studies done in college students and correlated all these different things that we correlated with, they would have to be done in a sleep lab with a polysomnography setup. So this system allows us to record data in a natural environment. But one of the studies that we did correlate it with is illustrated here, or examples here. It was from the Journal of American College Health in 2000. It was done at Brigham Young University with a population of about 300 students. And basically, they were looking at how well does GPA correlate with a number of different factors. And some of them were sleep. In fact, the major findings of this study was that the thing that affects GPA more than anything else is quality of sleep. And that's what's shown up here. All of these stars indicate the variables that had a significant impact on GPA. Again, a negative correlation. Weekday bedtime, weekend bedtime. That means the later you wake up on the on either the weekday or the weekend correlates into a, has a negative effect on GPA. The later you go to bed, the later you wake up, the lower your GPA is.
Are these all bivariate correlations?
Yes.
Did they do a regression analysis?
Yeah, in fact, that's what this is, or is a regression
analysis. Okay, so controlling for everything else.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that had a positive effect on GPA, use of a planner. Eating breakfast, I think, is that one. Study of spiritually oriented material. Remember, this was done at Brigham Young University, so they have that population of students that is oriented toward that way of studying, a way of thinking. This is taken directly from the study, from the paper. Weekday and weekend wake-up times have the largest relative effects on semester GPA. For each hour of delay in reported average weekday wake-up time, the predicted GPA decreased by 0.13. So again, a good sort of take-home message for the students. We were interested in how does sleep differ during spring break versus when they were here on campus during February. I'll give you 10 points if you record 10 days of data, I think it was 10 days of data, over spring break. This is just some descriptive statistics on what we found. They had, during spring break, they spent less time during wakefulness in the middle of the night than they did while they were on campus. They spent more time in REM, more time in deep, and more time in light sleep. So when they're on spring break, the quality of their sleep improves. We also looked at the circadian effect of the daylight savings time, which occurred on, I think, March 15th. So I said, I'll give you 5 points if you record one night of data within 3 days after the time change, which is that's the period when most people are trying to recover from the one-hour shift in time. Right? And we looked at how their sleep quality, or the descriptive statistics here, and then the ZO parameters in February compared to that one night right after daylight savings time. The daylight savings time had all these bars are, the green bars are lower than the yellow bars, indicating that the quality of your sleep was poorer right after daylight savings time compared to February. And they spent more time in wakefulness during daylight savings time compared to February. We also did an experiment. Well, a couple of memory experiments. This is one of them that is shown up here. And this left side of the graph is the experiment that we were aiming to replicate. It was published by Michael Walker from, I think he's at MIT. And he looked at procedural memory. Procedural memory is basically learning how to do some kind of motor activity, like, say, riding a bike is a procedural activity, or throwing a baseball, or writing your name is a procedural memory. Once you know how to do it, it's pretty much automatic. That's a procedural memory. So in this, the procedural memory task that we were doing was simple. They just had to type out 41324 on their computer keyboard as many times as they could in 30 seconds. So they would type 41324, 41324 as fast as they could in a 30-second period, and then they would take 30 seconds off. And then for the next 30 seconds, they would do it again. Okay? So 8 times in a row. Every other 30 seconds, they would try to do this procedural memory task. And so what's shown here is the number of sequences, correct sequences. If you mistyped it, it doesn't count, right? So the number of correct sequences that you could do in 30 seconds per trial. Most people can get about 23 sequences. I, for the life of me, I could never get it all to like 17. And you can do it any way you want. I said, it doesn't matter if you use one finger to do it this way or if you can do it this way. That's the way it worked best for me. I tried it both ways, and I was slightly better doing it this way than this way. But they could learn that procedural task any way they wanted. That was the point, is that they had to ingrain this into their procedural memory. So what this study did was they looked at how people went, did the task at, say, 10 a.m., and then retested themselves at 10 p.m., or if they took it at 10 a.m. and then retested themselves at 10 a.m. the next day. So the difference here is that there's a period of sleep that occurs between here and here, right? So what this is showing you is the score, the baseline score. The first time that the people in this study typed out the sequence, they got an average of 23. And if they retested themselves at 10 p.m. on the same day, their score went up a little bit. But if they had a period of sleep in between the time when they learned, first did the task, and the time they retested themselves, the score goes way, way up. So we try to do this in our class. Say, how well can we replicate this study? This is the data from our class. It's almost identical to this Walker paper that we discussed in class. And it, again, drives home the point that sleep is critical, especially for a procedural memory task. The data is not so clear for, say, a memorization task. Say, having to memorize a list of words or be able to do a word pairing test. Sleep is important for that, but it's not as critical as is for a procedural memory test. No.
So, like, would this procedure be applicable for students that play instruments?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. Or for athletes, say, or for dancers, for example. If you're trying to learn a dance step, right? Or if you are, say, trying to learn some kind of new baseball pitcher, for example. It's critical to have a period of sleep between when you first tried to learn the task and when you're tested on. So we're really happy that we almost identically replicated this task. This is another way of looking at that data. So the blue line represents the first time the person's tapped out the sequence and the score they got on each of those 30-second trials. So the first time they tried it, they got around 15 sequences. By the eighth time on that first 10 a.m. Learning, they got 23. Then this red line shows the people who were retested on the same day at 10 p.m. And what I thought was interesting is that this is the morning of the second day. And notice the start up here, right? So just that period of sleep has this dramatic increase in the score. There's not this sort of relearning aspect. See how this curve has to go up at 10 p.m. versus it's pretty much stable. You start out already at a high score, and you don't really improve because of that length of sleep, right? Over the course of your eight trials. Whereas over the course of eight trials at the first time you learn it, or at testing yourself at 10 p.m., there is that sort of immediate learning curve. We talked extensively about sleep debt. And sleep debt is basically if you are regularly sleep deprived. If you're getting less than 8 hours of sleep on a regular basis, you're building up your sleep debt. And most people compensate for that by, say, getting 6 hours of sleep during the weekdays, and then a little bit more sleep during the weekends. That's actually, like I said, detrimental to your overall quality of sleep. But that's how most people make up for it. This is not our data, but it's taken from a paper that we talked about in class, and it shows the repeated days of sleep restriction. So the people in this study were restricted to either 6 hours of bed or 4 hours of bed, and the control group here spent 8 hours. So not overall sleep, but how much time did you spend in bed? So if you spend 6 hours in bed over the course of 2 weeks, right, by the time you reach, say, the sixth day, you're already showing what's called the zone of impaired performance. The variable here was an attention task, a reaction time attention task. So compared to people who got 8 hours of sleep a night, by the sixth day, you're building up this sleep debt that gradually increases to the point of by 2 weeks, your performance is the same as being awake for 40 to 64 hours. So someone who is awake for two straight days would perform at this level the same as someone who got 6 hours of sleep a night for 2 weeks, which is probably what most people in this room are doing, right? Even I, the professor of this course, don't take my own advice sometimes, and I regularly only get about maybe 7 hours of sleep, sometimes 6 hours, rarely 8 hours of sleep. Yes?
The 8 hours of sleep, isn't that rather theoretical, or is it an average time of people
No, it's not. It's certainly not an average. The average for the American population is 6.7 hours, which was reflected in our students also. That's we're exactly on the average of the American population. But it's what the sleep researchers say you need to function at optimal levels, 8 hours of sleep.
Do you know if there's a difference between when you get that 8 hours, for example, night shift workers who work during the night and sleep during the day to get the 8 hours?
That's a great question. Night shift workers, if they can maintain that only working at night, right, and not say work at on the night shift for 3 weeks and then go back to day shift and then go back to night shift, that shifting back and forth is very detrimental. Night shift workers who only work the night shift repeatedly, say over the course of a year, they will get generally poorer quality of sleep because their daylight cycle is not synchronized with when they should be sleeping, right? But if they can in fact get good quality sleep during the daytime, then that's at least in the right direction. It's not ideal, but you can function that way. Anybody else have a question?
Any one of the group that did the finger tap on the same day, at 10 a.m., 10 p.m., did anyone take a nap?
We didn't control for that, no. But yeah, that would. So I'm going to show you a slide in a minute about the importance of naps. Question?
Yeah, when I took a sleep class here, we had a visiting professor from the Coast Guard. No, from the submarine.
Submarine base?
Yeah, that guy. And he came over. I think he said that the ideal sleep was 8.5. Did that change?
That's interesting. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's flexible.
So the data does indicate that you can get too much sleep. There's an interesting paper that we looked at in class about mortality and sleep. How long are you projected to live based on how much sleep you get? And if you get less than 6 hours of sleep, that's the same as getting more than 9 hours of sleep. So if you get too much sleep, that's just as bad as getting too little sleep. The optimal level here is around 8 hours, and I'm not sure what the discrepancy is. Probably
it's actually misremembering.
I've spoken to that guy, and it's interesting because he of course does work with the Submariners, right?
Yeah.
And where they can tightly control their circadian cycle, right? They have no idea of that.
I don't know what
daylight is.
No rhythms.
Right. So they can regulate the cycle of everybody on the ship. Very, very, right, very, very accurately.
And I guess my question is, why is too much sleep bad? Is it correlated with something else like
that? Yeah, so it's correlated with things like depression and diabetes that are also going to contribute to mortality.
But if you're not depressed and don't have diabetes or sleep,
you just have to get it.
Well, right, but there is a good correlation between too much sleep and depression.
Oh, okay.
There were some athletes in the class, and they were interested in how sleep quality could affect their athletic performance. And so we picked out one study where we looked at the effect of taking a nap in people who are sleep deprived. So the typical college student is sleep deprived, right? So in this study, they had male sprinters on the track team, and they had a partial sleep deprivation where they could not sleep between 11 o'clock and 3 a.m. in the morning. I forget how long they asked them to do this. Probably about a week, maybe a week and a half. I don't know if it's up here. And the control group, everybody in the study was partially sleep deprived. They couldn't go to sleep until 3 o'clock in the morning. And then they had a control group that just sat quietly between 1 and 1:30 in the afternoon. And then they had another group that took a nap between 1 and 1:30 in the afternoon. And they looked at all these parameters about alertness. They had decreased sleepiness, improved alertness, improved short-term memory, increased reaction time. And what was really sort of the take-home message from this study is talking about sprinters who would have to, run this short distance in as short a time as possible. And so the fraction of a second is critical. The people, the sleep-deprived athletes who did not have a nap on the 20-minute sprint time had a time of 3.9 seconds. but the people who just had an hour, half an hour nap, improved their score by a whole tenth of a second. So there were several swimmers in the class, and they went immediately and told their swim coach. And so we had a long discussion, the swim coach and I, about the importance of this, because of course, swimmers, they get up and they practice at 5:30 in the morning down at the athletic center before class. And then he has them come back and practice in the afternoon sometimes. And their meets are on after in the afternoon after they've been in class or on a bus ride for several hours. And I said, if there's anything you can do, is to tell them to take a nap on the day of their competition. Because their reaction time and their overall time to, especially the sprinters, is probably going to improve. So exam two came along, and they said, do we have to record our sleep data again? I said, well, what did you guys learn from the last test? The overall amount of sleep that you got was negatively correlated with the exam. The less sleep you got, the lower your score was. The more sleep you got, the higher your score was. So I said, I'll tell you what. If you can show me on your upload your ZO data, show me that you got at least 6 hours of sleep, I'll give you 5 bonus points for your exam. Just as an incentive. So I said, that's all you have to do is just get 6 hours of sleep, and you automatically get 5 points in your exam. Here's the exam two scores from the students that did not do it had a score of around, I think it was 79. The students who did get 6 hours of sleep had a score that was significantly improved. So again, I put this slide up and I handed their exam back and I said, see, here's the people who didn't get 6 hours of sleep. Here's the people who did get 6 hours of sleep. So hopefully sort of driving home this message of the importance of sleep. Finally, the last thing that we did in this course was I asked them to write a paper at the end of the semester, given their personal data collection from February. And over the course of the semester, when we talk about it in class and all the factors that affect sleep, I said, what do you want to do to improve your own sleep? You want to dream more? We actually did another experiment on dreams and dream interpretation. Do you want to just improve the overall quality of sleep? Do you want to get more deep, refreshing sleep? So pick one parameter of sleep that you want, of your sleep that you want to improve, and based on what we learned in the class, implement that. Do your own experiment on yourself, and try to improve your sleep quality. Show me the ZO data and write a paper on it, see if it worked. So some of them went so far as to take melatonin supplements, which is, melatonin is a hormone that's secreted by the pineal gland that is. It affects your circadian cycle, and it's taken for people who suffer from jet lag or seasonal affective disorder. So it's an over-the-counter supplement that will significantly affect sleep. So some of them use melatonin to see if they can improve their sleep quality. Others try decreasing their caffeine intake or their alcohol intake, or say sleeping with a mask on or earplugs in to decrease the noise in the dorm room. Or relaxation techniques. One student enrolled in yoga class to see if she could reduce her stress and anxiety so that she could improve her sleep. So I had fun reading the papers at the end of the semester to see how well the students actually learn or apply what they learned in the class. And some of the papers were interesting, and the feedback that I got was that they would continue to use the ZEO system that they had to buy for the course, and also the lessons that they learned to beyond the course, over the course of the summer or in the next year, to continue to apply what they learned in the class, which was really the success, I thought, of the overall semester. So I think that's the last slide I have for you. Yes. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Sleep.
I don't know. I've never been in a sleep lab, but I imagine it's difficult and certainly not typical of what you would do at home.
I was just going to say, I had one done a few years ago, and I felt it was a waste of time because I had trouble sleeping. I normally don't have problems sleeping. I don't have insomnia, and I certainly did when I was in a sleep lab.
So why did you get it done?
I was sleeping too much, but I think that really it was a result of depression at the time.
Yeah, so sleep deprivation is a therapy for people who have depression. Induced, you know, restricted sleep. Yes?
So the Zio system could help diagnose sleep apnea?
Well, it doesn't measure respiration rate, but it does. It could tell you how many times you're waking up. So you could just get maybe a good idea if you do have this regular wakings that could be due to sleep apnea. So then you could go see a physician about that. So the system has only been out a couple of years, and it's going through several divisions. And one thing that I'm hoping that they will do is that have the system have the ability to also wake you up, right? You can use it. You can use this system as an alarm clock. And there are other iPhone applications that are marketed as sleep aids. They're actually free, and you can download them to your phone, and then you put the phone on your mattress, right? And it uses the gyroscope sensor in the phone, the movement sensor, to realize when you're moving around in your bed. So when you're in REM sleep, you're in paradoxical sleep, you're in a state of paralysis, you are unable to move your limbs, so that the phone can detect that, and that's what it uses to tell you when you're in REM sleep or when you're not in REM sleep. And it will actually wake you up. You can program the application to say, when you detect I'm in REM sleep, have an alarm go off. And that's for people who want to experience, say, lucid dreaming. So they're waking up when they're in REM sleep and are remembering their dreams better and interacting with their dreams better. So I'm hoping that this system will be able to do that so that it will rely on the EEG patterns to wake you up rather than just the movement of the, you know, how much your mattress is moving.
Why does it doesn't work?
Some students reported that it didn't work. So like the girls in the class that had long hair and they wore ponytails to bed, they had trouble keeping their headband on, and it would fall off in the middle of the night. And if that happens, then it stops recording the data. So we had a lot of students that said, I had trouble, it kept falling off, or I didn't get a good recording that night. So we had to work through a lot of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, it doesn't work too well. So I'm hoping that the future versions will have, instead of a headband, it might be like a sticker that you just stick to your head instead of having to rely on this elastic. Yes.
Of all the papers you read from the students, which couple seem to stand out as the best ways for the students to improve their sleep?
Well, of course, it's individual, right? They all chose different parameters to try to investigate. But the best papers, or what I thought the best papers were, the ones that really put into action, that said, I really want to improve this aspect of my sleep. And so I'm going to try this, or I might try this, and did it actually work? And I'd say the majority of students took advantage of that. You know, the feedback that I received just from talking to students or in course evaluations was that they were happy to have, instead of just being lectured to and reading something in a book and then trying to remember it, that if they had a real-world application of what they were learning in class, then that was really what made the course valuable. Yes?
I was curious about the melatonin supplements.
Yeah, so for melatonin supplements, it's important to take them at the right time, right? So the package will tell you to only take them, say, an hour before you're ready to go to bed. Because the way melatonin is released in your body is that it's tightly tied with the light-dark cycle, and it's only released at nighttime. So it's basically as soon as the sun goes down, your melatonin increases, right? And then when the sun comes up, it's basically shut off and there's no melatonin released during the day. So when you, say, fly to Europe and you're on a 6-hour time shift and your melatonin is not only tightly tied to the daylight cycle, but it's sort of used to that same cycle of being released for 8 hours in the middle of the night and then off for 12 hours. And so you do get some melatonin release when it's daytime in Europe, right? When it's nighttime over here. So the melatonin supplements will help you if you to have to sort of ease off of one schedule and wean yourself onto a new schedule. But yeah, if you take a melatonin supplement in the middle of the day, it'll act like a sleep aid. Yes, Milton?
There was a slide about alertness and reaction time. How did you measure that, or how did the person measure
that? I think you were, that was from a study that we talked about in class. That wasn't something we did measured in our students.
Okay.
But we did have in that memory finger tapping task, we also had some other memory related tasks that we looked at that showed, again, I didn't show you the slides, but the general finding was that sleep improves your memory. If you can, say, learn a list of words and then get a night of sleep, you get a better recall after a period of sleep than after no period of sleep. Yes?
Chris, so you ran this class, this just works. So
yes.
Okay. I'm just curious, Dr. Early, if you have any of the students uncovered, like sleep apnea or any other sort of particular disorders, just from gathering those data. I was thinking of, sleep terrors, things like that, where you would know at what point you were in your sleep cycle when you were either jumping off.
None of them reported that. Some of them reported that they have problems with depression, and so they tried to implement their own sort of therapy related to sleep to improve their depression. The couple of students that did that, they had limited success. But none of them reported a new problem that came up. That was one of the concerns I had with asking students to experiment on themselves, right? So I left it totally up to them. I didn't want to have a controlled study where we had so many people getting 6 hours and the rest of them getting 8 hours. That would never get that through an IRB for a college class. But I was somewhat concerned about that. Also with the confidentiality aspect, because they shared each other's data. They only looked at it as averages from the class.
Were there any individual students who had a very unusual pattern of results?
So there was a couple of students who, had consistent scores in the 120s.
Hmm. Was there any indication why?
It's just an indicator of general quality of sleep. So they got 8 hours of sleep on a regular basis. They, in general, got more deep sleep. So that CQ score is calculated on all these different parameters. So the more deep sleep you have, the higher your CQ score is, right? The more overall sleep you have, the higher your CQ score is. So it adds things and subtracts things to get this CQ score. So the student who was getting averaging in the 120s, which I thought was amazing, she generally went to bed earlier and got 8 hours of sleep, so I think she was going to bed at like 9 o'clock and waking up at 6 o'clock, or 5 o'clock maybe.
How were her test scores?
She was one of the best students in the class. Probably one of the top two students in the class. In fact, I can look at that. So, but of course, I couldn't use her as an example. I didn't want to single her out.
Do you have any electronic devices near your bed as you're sleeping affect your sleep at all?
Yes, right. So that was one of the questions that I'd be interested in looking at the next time we offer this course. Three quarters of the students had the iPhone version versus this version of the system, and they'll go to bed with their iPhone. And there's even some evidence that people text in their sleep. Right? It's so automatic. They know where the numbers are on the keyboard, right? And they're sending text when they don't even know that. They're actually probably in light sleep or stage two sleep. And so, yeah, there is some evidence that the more electronic devices you have in your room, the poorer your sleep is. And a sleep therapist will say one of the best ways to improve the quality of your sleep is to make your sleep environment only for sleep and for sex, and that's it. So no TVs, no alarm clocks, no computer screens, only your bed, and be able to control the environment in terms of temperature and sound disturbances to minimize, make those optimal. And that's one of the best things you can do to improve your sleep quality. One more question.
I was wondering what you think of those alarm clocks that have a light in them that's supposed to simulate sunrise, or is it better to use something like that
That's similar to what the iPhone apps do, is that when it's detecting, so remember you have more periods of REM later in the night, in the thermion, they'll gradually waking you. So it's detecting how much your mattress is moving, and then it'll say, just send off a small, low tone, right? And that'll say, coax you from stage three back into stage two. And then 15 minutes later, it'll have a slightly louder tone, right? And then it'll sort of wake you gradually rather than wake up from stage four from that. That's going to have a bad effect on your overall sleep quality, your feel for the day. So the alarm clocks that do that with light have that same sort of approach.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Advancement Office, a little token of our appreciation, and thanks so much for staying till 4:30 on a Saturday night.